Welcome to Running Off the Rails. My name is Raymond O'Connor.
And I'm Ariel Rasko.
And today we're discussing how you can create world conflict and bring it to your game of Dungeons & Dragons. Whenever we look at some of the most popular fiction and fantasy, we see these huge scale battles where all of the allies and enemies that we've seen leading up to this final conflict clash on this huge scale. It's the climax of so many iconic series. We see this in series like Harry Potter, Star Wars, The Avengers: Infinity War.
Just the Battle of Helm's Deep makes The Two Towers my favorite of the Lord of the Rings movies. It's the perfect ending where all the pieces have finally come together.
So, of course we would want to bring this to our game of Dungeons & Dragons, but Dungeons & Dragons as a system, as a game, really struggles to deliver on this fantasy.
If you think of a combat with five players and a few enemies as being slow and sluggish and having a lot of actions happening, imagine a combat with 300 combatants or 1,000 combatants. So how can we create this fight? How can we get this world-ending battle that we want so badly in this system?
Well, I think that the tradition of the game, Ariel, would suggest that you're not supposed to do this. Back when Dungeons & Dragons was first created in 1974, there were a lot of war games. There were a lot of games for controlling multiple units of soldiers and doing battle against another player who also had multiple units of soldiers. And Dungeons & Dragons was a game that set out to be different in a very explicit way. It set out to be players controlling individual heroes, and that's the point of the game. But it feels to me like these world-ending conflicts that we see in all of our favorite media is the best way to communicate to your players that all of the choices they've made up until now have mattered and have consequences.
I think you're exactly right, that the natural flow of a D&D game, even if in these moments along the way, you're going through dungeons, you're talking to individual people, using persuasion checks, using your class abilities, eventually you create allies and enemies. And all these choices that you make along the way, we want them to feel like they actually matter. And that at the big fight at the end, if you hadn't succeeded in creating allies and defeating villains along the way, you would have lost the big fight at the end.
That's the ultimate promise of Dungeons & Dragons, that our choices matter. This is why people get so riled up about railroading, which is, I think, loosely misconstrued as this idea that the choices of the players don't matter. People hate the concept of railroading. But if you don't scale out and look at all of the individual adventures of your player characters in aggregate and bring the consequences of those individual adventures together in a climactic ending, did what happened on those individual quests actually matter?
I think it makes a lot of sense to at least try out some kind of big warfare system once or twice to see if you can create that huge satisfying ending that we all really are looking for. These things do come up. We have examples like Strahd, where you have armies fighting and you have towns with militias and a castle to defend. We have adventures like The Rise of Tiamat, where there are these big factions that are going to be in conflict with one another in large numbers. And if you think about your own homebrew campaigns, how often is there a king or a demon lord or an archbishop with a large following?
And I think that's the crux here. There are all of these attempts at world-scale conflict and trying to dissuade people from joining the enemy and persuade them to join your side. But then when the time comes to play out that world-ending conflict, there isn't a system for this. And what ends up happening is all of these enemies and allies that you've aggregated all together turn into the backdrop. The DM describes their conflict and tries to describe it in this epic way, how your allies and enemies are fighting against each other while the players fight against the leader of the enemy forces. And what ends up happening for anyone who's paying close enough attention is it turns out that none of this ever mattered.
Right. You have these encounters at the end with the big bad evil character, and that's a one-on-one fight. So if you would win that one-on-one fight, you would have won the war. That's what you're saying here, right? If you had won that individual fight, it actually didn't matter what all your other allies were doing, because you were fighting the big bad. And since you won, the war was won. And that's the way D&D is designed.
Yeah, like you could have missed every opportunity to kill that lieutenant and missed every opportunity to make that ally that you're bringing to the final fight. And it doesn't actually change the mechanics of your final showdown against the big bad in a meaningful way. And when DMs try to make it matter, they run into a lot of problems. So the example here would be, oh, well, don't have that ally only fight in the background. Have them actually participate in the conflict against the bad guy. Maybe that works with one ally, but before you know it, if the DM is controlling three powerful NPCs in the final fight against the bad guy, it's almost like the DM is playing against the DM in this final battle. And if the bad guy isn't strong enough to require that at least three powerful allies attend that final battle, well then, the players didn't actually really need to get all that help.
And those stack on themselves too. If you have the good ally NPCs and the evil NPCs all added to the fight simultaneously, you take both of those things, put them both in to make your game really dynamic. You're fighting lieutenants and enemies and making allies along the way. Your final combat is just a mess. And this is where we might want to pull in a separate rule set. MCDM has released a supplemental rule set called Kingdoms and Warfare, where you get to pit armies against each other and fight out these huge battles that we think are really emblematic of a campaign that feels worthwhile, where you've gotten to make enemies and progress in the natural way where you become a leader rather than just a lone fighter. But these rules are a little bit complex, and we're probably going to go into them in some more detail on a further episode. What different things you can do to run armies, and how specifically to run each round of combat. But first, we wanted to really dive into the question of where you can put these big combats into your adventures. This is something that Matt Colville specifically talks about in Kingdoms and Warfare. He says you should be able to have a campaign that's been running for a long time, and right in the middle of it, introduce Kingdoms and Warfare. So that's what we're going to try to do. We're going to try to show with a couple examples exactly how you could fit in these world conflicts into an existing setting.
And I think that you could use really any warfare system here. It seems to me that this warfare system in particular was built to pair really nicely with Dungeons and Dragons in a lot of interesting ways. So it's the one that we'll be talking about as the example.
So Ray, can you walk us through how an adventure like Rise of Tiamat deals with world conflicts and how a warfare system could improve the adventure?
Yeah, definitely. So just a heads up to anyone who's listening, we're going to be dropping some pretty heavy spoilers for Rise of Tiamat. The adventure is like 7 years old, so I don't feel too bad, but you have been warned. So this is your opportunity to leave, and we're starting now. So in the Rise of Tiamat, the DM is given a scorecard, and that scorecard allows them to interact with about 7 either factions or individuals that they can help and become more allied with. And what the adventurers do during the adventure will affect which allies they make or lose. So a great example early in the game is if you secure the flying castle. The Order of the Gauntlet are very happy that you secure the flying castle, and that will increase the chance that at the end of the adventure, they will offer to you the Order of the Gauntlet troops, and that they'll fight with you against the Cult of the Dragon.
When you say increase the chance, is there like an actual dice roll for this?
there's a points system that takes place throughout the course of the adventure, where every time you return from one of like the mini chapters of this campaign, you either score points with certain groups or lose points with certain groups based on the decisions that you've made in those mini chapters.
Yeah, it's really interesting that they already tried to build some kind of system. It sounds fine. Did you feel like the players had a sense of these points that you were keeping track of, or did you feel like that information was a little bit siloed with the DM?
I think that it's up to the DM to be as transparent as they want to be. I would really recommend that any DM that is running this let the players know that there is a system for deciding who will side with them at the end of the game, as opposed to them thinking that you're just deciding who likes them and who doesn't like them. But I mean, you could not tell your players. I think it's kind of up to the DM and their personal style. But yeah, it's really interesting that they built this system, and depending on who likes you, you get these things called factional assets. So you can get the troops of the Order of the Gauntlet. You can get druids and rangers to help you from the Emerald Enclave. You get Zhentarim assassins if you've sided with the Zhentarim. You get these Harper agents if you've scored enough points with the Harpers. Spoilers, if you are able to ally with the Metallic Dragons, a squadron of metallic dragons will actually help you in the final battle. You can ally yourselves with some devils who don't want Tiamat to roam free in the material plane because they have their own dealings that they want to make sure are being forwarded in the material plane, and they don't want Tiamat there. You can side with the giants because they hate dragons. You can get the Lord's Alliance army, and you can side with the Arcane Brotherhood.
It's interesting that they didn't move forward with this system in other published materials, because it sounds like it's pretty flexible. And you do have adventures like Storm King's Thunder, where you work pretty intimately with the Harpers sometimes. I wonder if they didn't like the system, or they just felt that it was too much to introduce to other campaigns. They wanted to keep them simpler, maybe.
Well, I think this actually exemplifies the point perfectly. So much of the campaign revolves around scoring these points for this eventual final battle. But then the book kind of just says, oh, you have these faction assets, and they kind of cancel out against these assets that the Cult of the Dragon has. So like the example here is the Cult of the Dragon has an army or a flight of chromatic dragons. And if you've allied with the metallic dragons, then it's really convenient as the DM to just have the chromatic dragons and metallic dragons be fighting each other in the background of this like final conflict. And they make it so that the chromatic dragons can't fight against you because the metallic dragons are keeping them occupied.
That's actually really interesting, because I'm imagining myself as a DM doing that exact thing. I would think, oh, entering a bunch of dragons into a combat is complicated. How do I still make this very cool? Oh, it's very cool if you have two dragon factions fighting each other. I think I probably would have done the same thing. I would have done exactly that. It's kind of railroading almost in a bad way, where no matter what the players would have done, this final eventuality was going to be that these dragons are part of a really cool fight, and they're not actually changing the dynamic at the end.
That's exactly the problem. You have this entire scorecard, and you score all these points, or you lose all these points, but if you don't score in the right places, then the final battle kind of like falls apart. So if you don't ally with the metallic dragons, what does the DM do with this flight of chromatic dragons? Do the players now, instead of fighting against these like powerful cultists, they're also fighting against an adult chromatic dragon of every color? You can't do that. You'll absolutely annihilate the players just because they failed to ally with that one faction. And this is where a warfare system becomes really helpful, because each of these individual assets becomes a single unit on the battlefield. I think this is a really good example of how a warfare system can really help to simplify something that is prohibitively complicated in the Dungeons & Dragons system.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, that you need some kind of system on top of this to get the effect that you want. And I wonder if in Rise of Tiamat, it sounded like they could have published this system totally separately and had it be a part of the D&D canon, but they chose not to. And I wonder if it's because they didn't get the right feel for payoff at the end. They're setting up a rule set to gain the allies, but to actually use the allies is not quite there. So you get a big buildup and you don't get the payoff. And so actually having a warfare system in place, I think, is really important for these systems that try to build allies over time.
I think that's exactly correct. And we might map these assets that you can gain during this adventure to a chess match, if that was your warfare system, or a game of Stratego. That could be your warfare system. But those systems aren't really made for Dungeons & Dragons, so they aren't perfect, right? It's like, oh, well, that sounds good in theory, but what if the DM is like a chess grandmaster? like, it's not gonna, the fantasy won't line up with the mechanics. And that's where this warfare system, I think, does a really good job, where each of these factions are represented by like a card that goes on this warfare system that has kind of like simplified stats. And it's almost like you're playing a D&D combat or a simplified D&D combat with each piece on the board, what would have been a player character, instead being like an entire unit. All the giants that are fighting with you on this massive battlefield are a single card. The flight of metallic dragons might be a single, very, very powerful card of flying cavalry units. And all of a sudden, you can have this battle and not just have it be going on in the background in a single sitting of Dungeons and Dragons. And I think that's a really compelling idea. The players can actually fight their army against the Cult of the Dragon army.
Yeah, I think all this stuff feels so natural when we talk about it like this. Some people might be curious if, you know, their game doesn't have this point system laid out for it, you know, where you just can really add in a warfare system at the end and it really helps tie everything together. You know, does it still work? Does this idea of warfare and world conflict as a part of your game really work well for other types of adventures? And I was reading through Kingdoms and Warfare, and I actually realized that this system would have made my campaign of Curse of Strahd feel a lot more successful and a lot more realistic. I guess I should put a spoiler alert here for Curse of Strahd, another very old game that I hope you've all played through by now. It's my favorite Wizards published material. But if you haven't and you don't want spoilers, skip ahead a few minutes. We'll be talking about some of the interactions that play out in Curse of Strahd. So there are, I think, three main domains that exist in Barovia, Strahd's demiplane. There's Valaki, which is the last stronghold against Strahd. You have Ravenloft, which is Strahd's large castle. And then you have a third that might not be so obvious, and that's Argenvost. And I really love thinking of these three places as domains within Barovia, each with their own interests. So if you look at Valaki to start, you have a place that could mount some sort of offensive against Strahd because it's very close to Ravenloft. And my players often found themselves trying to make allies in Valaki because these were the other humans, their natural allies. But there's actually something more interesting about this warfare system that I wanted to come into play in Valaki. There's specifically a special event where Strahd and many different forces, swarms of bats, vampire spawns, and Strahd himself, come and attack St. Andrel's Church, which you can think of as a big clerical stronghold. It fits already so well with the Kingdoms and Warfare and Stronghold systems. So when Strahd attacks, what can you really do as a party? What can you really do as a DM to create this sense of like an army attacking and defending this church? I remember running this and having my players planning ahead with Town's Guard and also trying to fight off individual vampire spawn before Strahd comes along. And it felt very difficult. It takes a lot of time to run this. The whole session is going to be combat, and you can make it more interesting or less interesting, but it's a lot of work outside of the normal rules of D&D. I could not just run combat. It would take way too long. And there are so many different people in so many different places, it honestly almost doesn't fit on one battle map. So this is kind of the first place where I think of Curse of Strahd as having really good places for Kingdoms in Warfare. And I'm wondering, Ray, if you can imagine like other campaigns you've played in where you had similar like skirmishes a little bit, where there were two opposing forces and they could have come to blows in some place but didn't. You know, I think this example of Curse of Strahd could show up in any campaign.
Absolutely. One that comes to mind immediately is there is kind of a like a war that happens, or a large-scale battle that happens in Out of the Abyss. When the players go to Blingdenstone, there's an army of oozes that are protecting the Pudding King. And there's this huge effort that goes on in Blingdenstone to gain allies amongst the different factions that live in Blingdenstone, to get them to help you fight against this army of oozes. I didn't know it at the time, but I created my own warfare system to represent the huge numbers of people fighting. And it was a slog. I was playtesting it live, right? So it was like 6 hours, and it went on for forever. And it worked, but it wasn't a success. I'd rate it a 4 out of 10, and my players might even rate it less if you gave them the opportunity. So it would have been really helpful to have a warfare system for that battle in Out of the Abyss. And I'm just thinking of Curse of Strahd, because I was a player for your Curse of Strahd game for a while, Ariel, before we had to disband the group.
Before I moved to California.
Before you moved to California. And I remember there was a section of Curse of Strahd that you homebrewed where we went to this Argenvost crypt, and we were going there specifically to kill a bunch of vampires while they were basically like in hibernation or sleeping. And I remember we against many odds had a very careful plan to slay these vampires, and I think we ended up killing something like 20 vampires. And I always in the back of my mind, I was wondering, what was the impact of our decision to go and try and slay these vampires? And more importantly, the impact of our success. And I always wondered, what would have happened if we had not chosen to do that? Would we have had to fight 30 vampire spawn at the same time that we were fighting Strahd in that final battle? I know that wasn't going to be the case. I knew that you would probably either kind of not remember and just have them not really show up in that final conflict, or kind of explain them away. You're not fighting those vampire that you decided not to go and kill. These other people are, and that's why you're able to get to Strahd. And it might make a narrative impact on the story, but it wouldn't have, didn't really change anything. The railroad still goes where the railroad goes, just the scenery changes on the way.
This whole thing with Argenvost was actually inspired by a desire for realism in my world. I really thought of Strahd having the ability to turn people into vampires and create allies while he was trapped in Barovia for millennia as something that I needed to explore. I wanted there to be more vampires that Strahd had turned in the game. So I created this little scenario where my players could try to attack these sleeping vampires. And, you know, in some sense, maybe my long-term vision was that they were actually a faction that wasn't perfectly aligned with Strahd, and some of the vampires could turn on Strahd if you gave them, like, ample reason to. And I thought that could kind of be an interesting way to play this out in the long term. But this whole thing started with this idea of allies and enemies and those being uncertain and malleable, which Curse of Strahd does really, really well. The members of Valaki that you could ally with against Strahd are mostly terrible people that you wouldn't want to ally with, so they could end up being your enemies. There's also this faction led by Lady Wachter in Valaki, who explicitly does want to take over Valaki and align with Strahd. So there's all this stuff going on, And then there's the city of Argenvost. And this thing was the most inspirational piece of Curse of Strahd to me. I think it's this really, really beautiful story, and very tragic, where there was a city that fought back against Strahd, and they attacked him and were decimated. And so you are left with these revenants, these Order of the Silver Dragon, and a dead Silver Dragon that have allied with Strahd in this weird way. Basically, you have this Order of Silver Dragons that were killed by Strahd decide that the best thing to do about Strahd would be to leave him locked in Barovia. So they have every reason to be enemies of Strahd, but right now, when you find them, they're actually his allies. And that really inspired me to also create these vampires who could be enemies or allies, because you have three different factions. You have the Valaki, which could be an enemy or an ally. You have Argenvost, which could be an enemy or ally. And you have these vampires, which could have been enemies or allies. And I got to really play with this idea of a world conflict. And then I had to fix the combats such that you were never fighting them all at once. I remember when you fought against Lady Wachter, I had her turn into this like crazy demon thing, and another character turn into like an ent to try to, you know, make the combat more palatable for everyone, such that there was like a main foe to fight against, and if you defeated that main foe, the minions would run away. I think that's like a very normal thing to do in D&D. But if I had, you know, these warfare rules at my disposal, I could have had you legitimately fight Strahd's forces in Ravenloft with units from Valaki against units of Lady Wachter's faction, and maybe with or against units from Argenvost, this Order of Dead Knights. Like, an Order of Dead Knights fighting against you is one of the coolest things you can add to your D&D campaign, but it's basically impossible with the rules of Dungeons & Dragons right now. It's like so Lord of the Rings, the themes, the fear of dead knights coming to haunt you is so cool, and the possibility that you could communicate with them and turn them so that they could be, you know, your allies instead, that's like literally straight out of Lord of the Rings. It's so perfect, and I just never really got the chance to do it because I didn't have the rules to do so. The way that the Curse of Strahd actually writes this encounter is that if you succeed in allying with these Order of Knights, they are put to rest and their souls move on. Like, your reward for allying with these knights is killing them. They no longer have to suffer. And it's this very anticlimactic moment. I mean, it can be nice and peaceful, and it's definitely a fantasy trope, but it's not increasing to this like big Helm's Deep-like combat at the end where all your allies and all your enemies are fighting all at once. I think it was a real missed opportunity.
Yeah, no, it seems like all of these adventures are primed for this opportunity for large-scale conflict and kind of feed into this fantasy, because I think Wizards of the Coast themselves loves this fantasy.
Right, they're good writers. Like, they write in these amazing conflicts.
Right, they like these tropes, and they want these tropes to be present in their adventures, and then you're always left disappointed by how these things actually turn out, because the way that it usually happens is it gets explained away. And now, for a change, we have a really solid way with these warfare rules that were introduced in Kingdom and Warfare to play out these huge conflicts in a reasonable amount of time, not using Dungeons and Dragons rules, but a side system. And that's really cool and really compelling. And now I think if someone was really interested to sink their teeth into this system and play an adventure, not just that is conducive to that system, but is made specifically to pair like a puzzle piece with this system, the book Kingdoms and Warfare has an adventure at the end called The Regent of Bedegar that is meant for this warfare system. And what it does is it lays out a local area that is maybe 100 or 150 miles wide, where there are these different powerful factions in play. And the players are told, basically, in a certain period of time, the evil tyrant, Lord Saxton, is going to arrive at their keep with his army, and he is going to attack. And they basically have a limited amount of time to gather as many allies as they can to help them in this impending battle, which they know is going to be a warfare system battle. So they know what units they have at their disposal. They're like warfare units, whether that be a levy of villagers who are like untrained soldiers. Maybe they have a unit of archers and a unit of cavalry, and maybe they have like one really good unit that's like well-trained cavalry because maybe one of the players was a gladiator in a past life and he was able to recruit his friends basically when he became leader of this keep. So they know what units they have, but they know that the army that's coming is more powerful than their army, so they need allies. So there are a bunch of factions that these players can interact with before Lord Saxton has time to rally his army and arrives at their keep. And in order to get the units that are associated with these different factions, the players need to go on Dungeons and Dragons adventures and try to succeed. And if they succeed, super simple, plays into the system, they get a card that they'll get to use in this eventual warfare system. And if they fail on all of their adventures, they won't have a strong enough army. But if they succeed on all of their adventures, their army will be very powerful.
I think this idea of an adventure fits really, really nicely by splitting up the D&D adventures like you were talking about with the warfare part of your campaign. What you get is a really nice separation where everybody knows they're building up towards something, and then when the time comes and you sit down at the table, that session of D&D is a warfare session. People are prepared to play something different, and it splits everything up really nicely. And also, you get a situation where there's build-up, and everyone's thinking about it, like maybe a real war. You're preparing and planning, and when the day finally comes, you feel like it's been set up for months in advance, like a real war, whereas a combat can just like spring up on you. I think, you know, with Curse of Strahd, going and laying siege to Ravenloft is a thing that you should plan for. It shouldn't be a combat that just shows up willy-nilly. So writing your adventures in these way, where you're specifically going out and trying to find allies, I think is perfect. And this Kingdoms and Warfare adventure, I think, would be a great way for everyone to get excited about a session of D&D where you're going to have like a long, maybe 4 to 6 hour combat ahead.
Absolutely. And something that I love about this adventure is it celebrates player agency. It gives the players lots of opportunities to make choices that do matter. The first choice that the players get to make is basically which adventure they want to go on. So they are presented with this spy that knows about a bunch of potential allies and gives the players kind of like a dossier of these are the players in the vicinity. What would you like to do with this information? Who would you like to try to either persuade to join you, or if you know that they're an enemy, to go and attack them before they have a chance for their army to show up. So there's a whole bunch of different adventure tropes here, and the players basically get to decide which adventure tropes sound appealing to them. All the way from like a pretty standard adventure, which is there's an evil necromancer in a tower who has an army of zombies and they're going to show up and join the enemy army unless you go and like kill this evil necromancer. It's like, cool. That is straightforward, cut and dry Dungeons and Dragons. All the way to a like a jailbreak, which is definitely Dungeons and Dragons, but a little bit kind of like more fringe. And then there's also this one adventure where you go on where you get to interact with these elves and try and persuade them to join your group. And this is going to be a little bit more of like a diplomatic adventure where, spoilers, skip ahead if you don't want spoilers for this adventure. The elves, they'll help you, but you have to help them first by killing a green dragon that is preventing their forces basically from leaving the forest. They can't donate any forces to your cause because they need them in the forest to fight against this green dragon, which is also in the forest. And they want you to go and chase off or kill the green dragon. But when you go and talk to the Green Dragon offers to join your army if you kill the elves instead. And there's an opportunity to get a Green Dragon unit card as the players if you decide to side with the dragon, which I just think is so cool.
I think this is the best part of the adventure. Like, how often is killing a dragon a reasonable side quest? Like, it actually makes sense in this context that to, you know, get an army of elves, the level of high stakes that you would need would be killing a dragon. But it's really just a side quest. And then once you get there, you can flip the whole thing on its head. It's so cool. But I will say, Ray, I'm pretty sure if I ran this, 100% of the groups I would run for it would try to get the necromancer on their side too. And they would just be like fighting with a green dragon and maybe a necromancer and a bunch of zombies and would maybe end up being like the bad guys. I don't know. I don't know if my players would be good.
If I know my players, they would probably do the same thing. I think this is probably a pretty decent place for us to lay this episode to bed, Ariel. We've covered a lot of ground. Is there anything that you just want to recap and maybe isolate some nuggets of applicable advice before we go?
Yeah, I think World Conflict feels realistic. It feels the most realistic for your players to go through and talk to important people and then use those connections in battle. I think that's what we want. I think that's what Wizards has written in the past, but they haven't had the system in place to do it. So these world conflicts, I think, are natural and super important and definitely worth trying to put into your games.
I think you hit the nail on the head, Ariel.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Alrighty, well, until next time, I'm Raymond O'Connor.
And I'm Ariel Rasko.
And thanks for listening to Running Off the Rails. If you enjoyed Running Off the Rails, please like, follow, and review our show on your platform of choice. Please follow our Instagram, Running Off the Rails, for notifications whenever we release a blog post, a new episode, or new content on the DMs Guild. If you prefer a specific type of content, please send us a message on Instagram. The jam you are listening to is Hoist by Andy G. Cohen, and you can find Hoist and more of Cohen's music on the Free Music Archive. You can find links to all of our content at runningofftherails.com or on our Facebook page, Running Off the Rails.